From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. There was a major escalation today in the biggest political crisis in years in the Chinese territory of Hong Kong. On the streets of central Hong Kong, police fired tear gas and rubber bullets at protesters. The demonstrators oppose a new bill their leaders are considering that would allow people accused of wrongdoing to be sent to mainland China for prosecution. The BBC's Danny Vincent is at the scene of the protests.
Night has fallen here in Hong Kong, and police have pushed hundreds of thousands of protesters off of the streets. But I'm in one pocket of the city where a small group of very young students, really, have set up barricades and are trying to push the police back. They feel these are their streets, and they don't feel comfortable with the excessive use of violence that the city has seen today. They want to try to stay here and occupy this city, but the police have a very different idea.
And police have a different idea in that they have used rubber bullets and tear gas against some of these protesters. Is that designed to basically stop the protests, push the demonstrators out, or what?
Many people thought that what would happen here today would be somewhat of a rerun of what happened in 2014, when hundreds of thousands of protesters came to the streets and they tried to occupy this city. They were somewhat successful in their protest. They stayed on the streets for more than 70 days. People expected something similar to happen here today, this afternoon, but that's not happened. The police are incredibly determined to clear these streets. The use of rubber bullets are extremely rare in Hong Kong. Tear gas and pepper spray, they've both been fired, and many people have been hurt by that. But what's perhaps more important than that is that many Hong Kong people are now furious. I heard one man say, violence begets violence. He feels that what has happened here today is unrecognizable. This city is slowly becoming just like any other Chinese city. They're very angry, they're very worried, and they don't want to go home.
We heard, Danny, behind you there, someone shouting. Can you tell us who that was?
There are lots of people shouting. So I'm on a long street in central Hong Kong. In some ways, it looks like an ordinary night. You can see the neon lights of the skyscrapers above me. But on street level, well, there must be hundreds of protesters roaming the streets. You can see the lights, the sirens of police cars in the distance. They think that at any moment the police might charge this street again. But they are very determined to stay. So they're shouting, they're chanting. They're determined to stay here because they think that this is their city. And now it's time for the authorities to listen to them.
Could you tell us about the bill that sparked these protests in the first place? A bill that in itself they seem to be threatened by, but also it's become something of a lightning rod for their greater concerns about Chinese control over Hong Kong.
That's correct. Now, Hong Kong is part of China, but it is granted several freedoms not enjoyed in the rest of China. Freedoms such as freedom of assembly, which people are championing today, freedom of press, and, of course, an independent judicial system. Now, with this extradition bill, many people fear their independent judicial system would be threatened because they think that technically any Hong Kong citizen, any of the people that have taken to the streets today, they could be summoned to Beijing and charged for crimes. Now, the main issue is that many people don't have faith in the Chinese legal system. They think that law is arbitrary in China. They think that the law courts are controlled by the Communist Party. There are forced confessions. There are many human rights abuses. So Hong Kong people don't feel very confident with the prospects of that extradition law. And they seem to be very determined to make sure that their feelings are heard. And this bill could be postponed or perhaps even scrapped.
In the meantime, Hong Kong's leader, and there is a separate leader there from the mainland in Beijing, the leader Carrie Lam is endorsing the bill. What does she say?
That's right. She says that the bill closes certain loopholes in the Hong Kong legal system. She says that it would only be used against extremely severe examples of crime. She has attempted on several occasions to reassure the Hong Kong public that this isn't what they fear.
One other thing, we know that some of the protesters that are dressed in black T-shirts. Many of these are young, as you said, young protesters. Some of them are unfurling parasols. as were used in the 2014 pro-democracy protests as well, as kind of a symbol of the movement. They're covering their faces because they're worried about the electronic surveillance used by Beijing, facial recognition technology, and they don't want to be brought up on charges. When you speak to the protesters, tell us about what some of them have specifically said to you about their own concerns.
I spoke to a protester earlier today. He was standing on a bridge shouting at the police from a distance. He was shouting in Cantonese and shouting in English. And one expression he used very loudly was, "Violence begets violence." He was furious that rubber bullets were fired. He was furious that tear gas had been fired. He didn't recognize this city, and that frightened him. But he felt more was soon to come.
The BBC's Danny Vincent speaking to us on Skype from central Hong Kong. Danny, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, back in Washington, there's news today that the Trump administration is invoking executive privilege over materials connected to the 2020 census. Now, Democrats on the House Oversight Committee have asked for those documents as they try to investigate how and why the administration went about proposing to add the question, "Are you a citizen?" to the census next year. But this claim of executive privilege in response to lawmakers comes on the heels of the House vote yesterday, which authorized committees to enforce subpoenas as part of their investigations. So let's get the latest from NPR's congressional reporter, Kelsey Snell. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
So these documents could include those papers that were recently discovered by the estranged daughter of a deceased Republican strategist who helped write this proposal for the Republicans for this question, "Are you a citizen?" And he plainly, reportedly, said in some of those recently discovered papers that that question on the census would benefit Republicans. Republicans have testified before Congress that the question was being added to help minorities, to help, the Voting Rights Act. So we aren't sure if these are the documents that are part of this executive order, or rather executive privilege. But what are both sides saying right now?
Well, Democrats are saying that they are seeking a wide range of documents because they're trying to figure out exactly how the administration reached the decision of asking for this question to be added. And Elijah Cummings, who's the chairman of the Oversight Committee, said today that they've been asking for these documents for more than a year. And he'd offered that if they begin producing one or two categories of documents, they'd be willing to postpone the vote on contempt. But, you know, both they've had that offer declined. Mm. So they're saying that they have to push forward with contempt as the only possible way to get the documents. Now, Republicans are saying that this is an extraordinary step and that Democrats just simply haven't done enough to work with the administration to make sure that the information gets provided.
And this vote of contempt, this is whether to recommend that the House hold Attorney General Barr and Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross Jr. in contempt because?
I mean, it is over these documents, as we said. They want to compel Barr and Ross to appear before the committee and to turn over the documents that the committee has been requesting. Now, this is part of a broader push by Democrats to try to compel the administration as a whole to comply with a number of investigations. Now, this is separate from the contempt vote that the whole House did yesterday regarding right. Attorney General Barr and former White House Attorney Don McGahn. But this is part of the broader push by Democrats to try to get the White House to comply with their investigations.
And just remind us, Kelsey, because there are so many votes going on right now. What was that vote yesterday about?
That vote yesterday was about holding, as I said, Attorney General Barr and Don McGahn in contempt for not appearing before the Judiciary Committee. Mm-hmm. So as we will continually remind listeners, the House Democrats are pursuing a number of avenues to try to reveal what the administration knew on a number of issues. We're talking about the president's taxes, his business dealings, this question today of the census, and the Russia investigation that has been ongoing and was related to the Mueller report. So Democrats say that they are trying to get to the bottom of the good governance of this administration.
And in the news of the last few hours, just remind us, I alluded to it a little bit, of the debate over adding this census question. The Democrats have long suspected the reasoning that Republicans gave for it.
Well, Democrats say that adding a question about citizenship to the census threatens the ability of people to respond accurately, and it discourages people, particularly minorities, from interacting with the census in an honest way or even at all. And they worry that it will undercount the number of people in some of the more vulnerable populations in the country. They say that adding this on instills fear in many people. And the risk there, Democrats say, is that if people are undercounted, then the number of people who would go to Congress from different areas with high immigrant populations would be miscounted. And they say the stakes are incredibly high. Republicans say that they need this information in order to, as you said, enforce the Voting Rights Act. And they say that this is something that the administration is trying to do to better understand who is in the country.
And, of course, those documents that were recently discovered, an incredible story by the daughter of a deceased strategist, seem to be saying that his reasoning, at least, was that a question on the census, are you a citizen, would benefit Republicans and other whites, as he put it. So we will follow this. NPR's congressional reporter, Kelsey Snell. Thank you so much, Kelsey.
You're welcome.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from EmberWave, the revolutionary new personal thermostat that's designed to help you find thermal wellness in any situation. EmberWave can put you in control of your comfort in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, in restaurants or theaters, after a workout, at home, and more. Learn more at EmberWave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. EmberWave, own your temperature.
There are 23 active Democratic presidential candidates, according to NPR's count, and we have been speaking with many of them. Today, California Congressman Eric Swalwell in Washington. And Congressman, you have got a record of accomplishments on Capitol Hill already. What part of that record do you plan to highlight in your campaign for the White House?
It's not just my record in Congress that I'll take on my campaign to the White House. It's the experience of being the first in the family to go to college, knowing why people work hard and what they expect it to add up to, and being a father of two kids, paying off our student loan debt, fighting insurance companies, and worrying about their safety in schools. But in Congress, what distinguishes me, I think, from a lot of the other candidates is you're not just getting a voice for the future and a 38-year-old candidate. You're getting somebody who has fought for access to education and the legislation I've written around student loan debt relief, who sat on the House floor for 26 hours after the Orlando Pulse shooting and worked to get a majority in the House so that we could pass background checks, and as our democracy was on the line after the Russian interference attack, led the way in the work I did with my House Intelligence Committee colleagues and on the Judiciary Committee to make sure the rule of law was standing.
Talk about your interest then in safety and specifically the gun buyback programs that you've proposed.
My top priority as president will be to make sure that in every community, whether it's at a church, whether it's at a school, or whether it's on your street, that you're free from gun violence. What we can do is pass background checks in the Senate, which I would sign into law. I'm the only candidate calling for a ban and buyback of every single assault weapon in America. But also, I've gone across America to places like Philadelphia and Indianapolis and Houston and Chicago to understand the root causes of gun violence in those communities, seeing that a lot of times it's just a failure to invest in hope, like good jobs and education and healthcare for people who really, really need it.
So there are a couple of aspects to this that I want to ask you about. One is when you talk about buying back every single assault weapon, it seems pretty inconceivable that that could be done on a practical level. How would you do it even financially? What would fund it?
I'm not even the first person to conceive it. Actually, the Australians did it in the 90s after a mass shooting there. They were able to buy back 700,000 assault weapons. My plan, and we've introduced it into the Congress, would have a two-year period to buy the weapons back at market rate. If people do not want to sell their assault weapon back, they could possess it only at a shooting range or a hunting club. But the idea being that these weapons belong on our battlefields, not in our communities. The cost could be as high as, $15 to $20 billion, we estimate. But I believe that is a lot less to pay than the cost of loss for a family who would lose someone, and also the cost of the trauma that our kids are going through.
You know, did you say it would cost $15 billion to buy these assault weapons back?
My legislation proposes to pay market rate. And so, you know, just our estimate is that it would be about a $15 to $20 billion program, which of
course
is...
Where would you get that?
Reduce what we spend on national defense. You know, our national defense budget continues to go up, up, and up, and we have no major combat operations. So, you know, the nuclear weapons budget, which is $1 trillion over 30 years, is one place.
Some of your competitors in the Democratic field have come out with $1 trillion proposals for reckoning with climate change. Where does climate change lie on your priority list?
I come from the generation that's going to actually live with the consequences of inaction in the past on climate change. You know, it's estimated that in 12 years, if we continue on this path of essentially not addressing carbon emissions, the effects will be irreversible. What I would like to do in my plan would invest in direct air capture technologies like carbon capture, carbon sequestration, and carbon reuse so that we can bring our country to carbon neutral or negative. What we can do if we seek to take, say, in the first year, 10 million metric tons of carbon out of our oceans and out of our air, and then have a goal to double it each year. The cost will come down as we do that through economies of scale, and that's the way to get to carbon neutral.
Would you push for a carbon tax?
I'm open to that. I'm certainly open to anything that will reduce the carbon in the air, but also to allow people to keep working. And that's been the challenge here as I've gone across the country. You know, I talk to pipe fitters and laborers, and they tell me that if your plan just puts me out of work, you know, I'm going to vote for my job. And I get that. And I want to make sure
what
that...
What do you say to them?
Well, I tell them that, you know, there's a way for us all to be responsible in the companies that are emitting carbon and the government who has an interest in people working and individuals and having responsibility to, you know, get current skills, that you shouldn't have to lose your job, that these companies should have technologies that bring their emissions down to carbon neutral or carbon negative. And for the next generation of workers, we need to make sure there's a skills bridge to the green collar economy of wind, solar, and alternative fuel cells.
As you mentioned, all of these issues come at a cost in terms of jobs, and this is always an issue, of course, for voters. But I wonder to what extent that you think you're going to have to reconcile that issue with your stand on these climate change matters.
I want to take away that false choice for workers that you have to choose between your job or addressing clean air and clean water.
Some people, is it really a false choice? People who work especially in areas that are steeped in coal and have worked in coal for generations?
If we put an expectation on coal companies or fossil fuel companies that they're going to have to bring their sites, you know, to carbon neutral and that they're going to have to invest in skills training and, you know, pay and benefits for their workers, I don't think it's unrealistic. But people at their core, they want to work. They don't want, you know, a subsidy or a handout. They want to work, or they want to have, you know, real skills that can allow them to have that dignity of work. And I think we've missed that in the past. You know, in the president is missing it now in his, you know, trade proposals where he's giving aid instead of trade to farmers. The frustration isn't as much about, you know, losing the paycheck. It's just the dignity and being able to provide for your family and look them in the eyes and let them know that, you know, you are working in providing for them.
Congressman Swalwell, a number of other Democrats running for president have called for Medicare for all. Senator Bernie Sanders has a bill out that would potentially eliminate private insurance altogether. If you're elected, what would you do to better health care in this country?
I like most of Senator Sanders' bill. I've supported it. The part that I would modify is I would still give people a choice for private insurance. So Medicare for anyone who wants it would be my modification. But I don't want to limit this debate to coverage. Coverage is important. But what we've always done best as a country is find the unfindable and solve the unsolvable and cure the incurable. And I see an opportunity to lead by, you know, expanding our investments in genomics research and data sharing and targeted therapies, and seeing innovation also as a way to bring down the cost, extend the quality of life, and put a lot of new jobs in the life sciences in disconnected communities that need it.
One of the things that you've said in your statements is that voters should elect a young family to the White House. When you do, you'll get a voice that fights for solutions on safety, prescription drugs, health care, child care. You don't mention foreign policy and America's relationship with the rest of the world. What would your foreign policy priorities be?
We're going to get our friends back. And the way you reduce what we spend at home on national defense, which is at a cost of repairing our bridges and roads and putting tablets in the hands of our kids or having affordable prescription drugs, the way to reduce what we spend is to have friends in the world to rely on treaties. And so as a member of the House Intelligence Committee, I think the American people have seen I've defended our democracy as it's been on the ropes. I've stood up in favor of our allies rather than to diminish them. So I will take the oath and then go on a global affirmation tour and assure NATO allies that we're still with them, assure the Japanese and the South Koreans that we value our presence in their country as a way to check China and look into North Korea, but also to pledge to host in the United States a new climate summit so that we can lead from the front when it comes to climate.
What would you do about Russia's influence in U.S. elections, specifically through manipulation or compliance by tech companies?
The Russians will feel the pain until they acknowledge what they did.
But what does that mean,
feel treaty?
Feel the pain.
Right now, they've caused, in part, the destabilization of Eastern and Western Europe and what they've done in Syria and the migrant crisis, and they've seen a fractured Europe, which has led to, I think, an inability for countries to unite and stand against Russian aggression. They've put pressure on countries who want to join NATO. And it takes, I think, American leadership to stitch those countries back together, to find ways and resources for them not to be so dependent on Russia, so that when you need Russia to feel the pain and you need to isolate them and alienate them, you can do so in a unified way.
California has certainly felt the impact of the immigration crisis going on the U.S.-Mexican border. And I wonder what your proposal would be to handle immigration, knowing that there are more than 100,000 migrants who tried just last month to get into the United States.
On immigration, I would bring leadership where the president gives us only showmanship. I would dramatically increase the humanitarian resources there, the number of judges to adjudicate the cases, the facilities that process individuals so they're not sleeping on concrete slabs and only able to have space blankets. I don't disagree with the president that Mexico has a big role to play in all of this. I think he's right to identify that. And I just believe that the way the president talks about Mexicans and the way that he engages with Mexico is not productive. And again, we need leadership rather than showmanship.
California Democrat Congressman Eric Swalwell, who's running for president. Nice to speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
The states of Ohio, Arkansas, Georgia, Missouri, and Alabama have passed new restrictions on abortions. The state of Maine has done just the opposite. This week, Maine's Governor Janet Mills expanded access to abortion in the state. She enacted a law that allows nurses and physician assistants to perform abortions, not just doctors. Maine Senator Linda Sanborn worked in family medicine for 25 years. Senator, the law would allow nurses and physician assistants to perform abortions, but are they as prepared as a licensed doctor would be to conduct the procedure and then deal with any kind of complications?
Yes, I think that there is research that shows that these advanced practice clinicians can provide these procedures just as safely as physicians do. These practitioners should be trained in women's reproductive health, but they can have just as much skill at doing those jobs if that's the area that they too specialize in.
Even if there are complications after the procedure?
Yes, even if there are complications, these folks usually have a physician that they can readily access. So knowing what to look for if there are complications and making those referrals would be done just as if you were a family physician doing this kind of procedure.
So it sounds like it gives women in Maine more options of places to go. But what is the problem that it is designed to resolve?
It is to help improve access, particularly in rural areas of the state, so that women don't have to travel long distances to get the care they need, particularly in northern Maine. So there are physicians' offices scattered around the state that may be doing the procedure, but a lot of time women have to travel to a clinic that's only in a larger city to be able to access this kind of healthcare.
Now, California has the same law that Maine now has, and some of your neighbors, Vermont and New Hampshire, are already doing this as well. What have you learned from their experiences?
We have learned that it is just as safe for these advanced practice clinicians to perform it. There was actually a study done in California, I believe at the University of California, San Francisco, where they had groups of physicians who performed the procedures, and they had no worse outcomes. So we're quite confident.
At the same time, there are some healthcare providers we know who are not comfortable providing abortions, and that is likely the case not only with doctors, but also with some nurses and physicians' assistants. Will they have the ability to say, I'd rather not do this?
Absolutely. No one is forced to do it. It only allows someone who is trained to do these procedures to be able to do that should they desire.
With the more restrictive laws about abortion being passed in Georgia and Arkansas and Missouri and Ohio, it sounds like you're doing something that includes making a statement in Maine. How do you place what Maine is doing in the larger picture?
You know, it's my own personal belief that other parts of the country are going the exact wrong direction. We know that there is strong support to continue access to legal, safe abortions. And I believe that whether or not an abortion should be legal, that's not the question. And we shouldn't let political rhetoric govern health policy.
That's Maine Senator Linda Sanborn talking to us about a new law that will allow nurses, physician assistants, and other healthcare professionals to perform abortions in Maine. Senator, thank you.
Thank you very much, Lisa.
A second suspect has now been arrested in the shooting of former Boston Red Sox great David Ortiz, Big Papi. He was shot at a bar in Santo Domingo in his native Dominican Republic Sunday night, in the back at close range, flown by the Red Sox to Boston, where he's now being treated in a hospital. Michael Levinson is covering the story for the Boston Globe. And Michael, do we know if the two suspects knew Ortiz? I mean, everybody in the Dominican Republic probably did, but do we know if he was targeted?
We don't know that yet. He appears to have been targeted just by the nature of the crime. They've said that one of the suspects drove the gunman on a motorcycle to this bar. The gunman hopped off the motorcycle, shot Ortiz in the back, hopped back on the motorcycle, and then they sped off. The first suspect, the driver of the motorcycle, was captured almost immediately when a crowd surrounded him and really beat him quite brutally and held him until police arrived. The second suspect, who's the suspected gunman, was arrested Tuesday night.
Hopefully we'll find out more about that. But meanwhile, the Red Sox paid to have him flown to Boston for this medical care. Worse than we thought originally. What is his condition now?
He's still in the intensive care unit at Massachusetts General Hospital. He's in stable condition. He underwent a second surgery on Monday night into early Tuesday morning when he got to Boston. And so he's in recovery mode right now. We've heard that he's taken his first steps in the hospital, but he's going to have to be in the hospital for a few more days and watched very closely.
Yeah. Well, on the face of it, a top athlete, a well-known athlete being gunned down senselessly like this from anywhere would be something we'd want to note. But also in this case, he's such a fixture in sports and in Boston sports. Let's remind listeners why. Considered one of the best clutch hitters in history, great player. Just a little more about how he was such an important athlete to the Sox.
Sure. I mean, Big Papi, I mean, he is an icon in Boston. He's beloved here, mostly because he helped us crack the 86-year curse and win the World Series in 2004 and then again in 2007 and 2013. And he's also just a sort of larger-than-life figure. He's swaggering. He's got a megawatt smile. He's got diamond-encrusted jewelry. And people just seem to gravitate towards him. He's got this magnetic personality. Also, after the Boston Marathon bombing, he delivered this very memorable, profane, and inspirational speech at Fenway Park that just kind of lifted the city's spirits and seemed to capture the whole defiant spirit of Boston and Boston Strong at that moment. So he's just a huge figure in the landscape here in the city.
Well, and we have a little of that sound, what we can play. But
right.
It was, again, it was a spontaneous moment, and it really changed the frightened mood of the city. It sort of catalyzed the strength that had been gathering and really forged it. Let's listen.
This is our city. And nobody gonna dictate our freedom. Stay strong. Thank you.
Out of nowhere.
Yeah. Just listening to that, I still get tingles because I remember exactly the feeling in the city at that time. And he just sort of punctuated, you know, the raised fist that the city was feeling at that time against this horrible terrorist act that had happened here. And it was just a few days afterward. And he just captured in that one speech the kind of sense of we're not going to be knocked down by this. We're going to fight on and we're going to come together as a city.
And the important word, we, you know, this was his adopted city. And of course, the reaction to the shooting has been extraordinary at home in the Dominican Republic. But here you see Pedro Martinez, another player, openly crying at a press conference. You've got the other teams, the Bruins, you know, in the finals tonight with the Blues, the last game of that hockey series, the Sox playing. There's a lot of people, it's summer, and a lot of people are talking about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, fans, former players, everyone's just pouring out concern for Big Papi. And, you know, if you've seen President Obama tweeted a message of concern and support for Big Papi. You know, so there's been political leaders, fans, and the Dominican community. It's just been a huge outpouring of concern.
And, Michael, I just want to be clear because, again, the conditions seem more serious, serious injuries to organs. Is his life endangered?
The sense now is that his life is not in danger, but we don't know what his life will be like going forward or how long he will be in recovery. There's been very little medical information given out. And, you know, any time that your small intestine, your large intestine, and your liver have been pierced by a bullet, you're facing, you know, very serious road ahead. So the doctors that we've talked to have said, you know, he has to be monitored now very closely for infections and other problems associated with the surgery. And the long-term prognosis, you know, in terms of what his functioning will be is not clear. We do know he's making good recovery. He's walking around. He seems to be in good spirits. He flashed a smile to people that have come to visit him. So those are all positive signs.
Yeah. Boston Globe reporter Michael Levinson on Big Papi, David Ortiz. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And to Florida now. We've reported on the governor recently signing into law a bill that will allow teachers to carry a firearm in school, which is stirring up a lot of feelings across the country. But in many communities, for kids, being around guns is not a new concept. YR Media's Natalie Bettendorf talks to educators and students in Kansas and Iowa, where gun safety training is part of life, even at school.
Alexis Buxton is 18. She lives in Scott City, Kansas. It's a small town, like less than 4,000 people small. And like many kids there, she grew up around guns.
My mom has a concealed carry gun. My dad has a gun. My sister and her husband are both avid hunters.
So Alexis was excited when she reached the point freshman year when she could take a course on hunter education, where she'd learn how to use guns safely and for class credit.
If I walk up to Alex and hand him a firearm, what's the first thing he should do?
In Kansas, teaching hunter education in school has long been funded by the state's Department of Wildlife, Parks, and Tourism. It even has its own promotional video.
Point the muzzle in a safe direction, right?
In the video, an adult instructor stands in front of a class of gangly teens and walks them through the basics of gun safety, while a narrator explains the program's virtues. But in places still reeling from school shootings, hunter education brings up serious concerns. Matthew Harris is a graduate of Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. After the shooting in Parkland, he helped start March for Our Lives Tallahassee at Florida State University. And he feels skeptical about hunter ed.
Gun training is not unimportant, but I think the best way to eliminate school shootings is to not have guns in schools. I've never been the biggest fan of hunting in the first place, but obviously since my high school was shot up, it soured me on hunting even more, I think.
Matthew and others in the March for Our Lives movement have called for tighter gun regulations as a way to prevent future school shootings. But there are parts of the country where learning to shoot can seem as common as riding a bike. And there, some students feel it's more important than ever to teach kids how to respect guns through firearm safety training.
All right, cheek down on the stock, gun up a little higher.
In Worth County, Iowa, Dan Block is teaching a seventh grader how to shoot clay pigeons.
Are you ready?
Cool.
You got it!
Yeah! I did it!
Most states require people to take a hunter education course to get a hunting license. In Iowa, you have to take the class if you're born after 1972. Block teaches it year-round, mostly to kids.
I teach the kids about muzzle-loading rifles. That's a really good background on why and how a gun works. And then in the second shooting program, I teach the kids how to reload rifles. And then we shoot AR-15s.
That's right, AR-15s. The same kind of gun used in several recent mass shootings, including Parkland last year. Block doesn't see the issue with teaching kids how to use these guns.
You've got everybody familiar with guns around here, and we don't shoot each other in the schools with them.
I just think that's a flawed statement to make. It's very naive and very dangerous.
That's Matthew Harris from Parkland again.
People can know everything there is to know about guns and still go out and commit a school shooting. Students are emotional. They're teenagers. They could decide to do something really bad.
Back in Kansas, Alexis Buxton says she does worry about school shootings. And her school offers drills for active shooters in addition to hunter ed. The way she sees it, both matter. But if she had to pick just one...
I think a lot of people think that it's more important that we get kids like out shooting and out respecting guns before something like that happens in our own community.
So far in 2019, there have been more than 40 people killed or injured in gun-related incidents at K-12 schools around the country. For Here and Now, I'm Natalie Bettendorf.
And Natalie's story was produced by Youth Radio's new network of journalists and artists. They're now called YR Media. Good for them.
Former leaders of the Environmental Protection Agency are sounding the alarm about the Trump administration's record of rolling back environmental regulations. Rollbacks, they say, are endangering public safety. Four former EPA administrators voiced their concern to the House Energy and Commerce Committee yesterday. Three of them are Republicans, and among them, Christine Todd Whitman. She was EPA administrator under President George W. Bush. She was also the governor of New Jersey. Governor Whitman, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you, Lisa.
In your testimony yesterday, you cited a 2018 study that said the Trump administration, quote, has explicitly sought to reorient the EPA toward industrial and industry-friendly interests, often with little or no acknowledgement of the agency's health and environmental missions. What are some of the most prominent examples of that?
Well, the rollback of the tailpipe emission, the mercury standard, the rollback of the setback rules for mining on where they can dump their tailings, and that's under the Clean Water Act. There have been some 85 regulatory rollbacks. And while it's appropriate to always take a look at regulations from time to time because they may become redundant, things may have changed sufficiently to allow for an elimination of a regulation, but these are not being done in a careful, thoughtful manner with a real focus on public health. And this is not a zero-sum game. We have proven over and over again you can have a healthy, clean environment and a thriving and growing economy. And they seem to be overlooking that, making it seem as if everything that the EPA does is just designed to destroy the economic growth. And that just isn't the case. It's about protecting human health. And that's what's critical here.
Well, let me ask you about that balance. When you were the EPA administrator, how did you balance the need to protect the environment with the government's responsibility to not
burden or overburden business and industry? Because it is a bit of a balancing act.
It is a balancing act. You're constantly having to make trade-off decisions. But for instance, one of the regulations of which I'm most proud that we got through was a reduction in the emissions from non-road diesel engines. That's tractors, backhoes, those kinds of things, which were more problematic for human health than actually the ones on the road. And what I did was put together an engine manufacturer, the environmental group, the Office of Management and Budget at the White House, and the EPA staff. And I said, sat them in a room and said, work this out. And they came up with a regulation that satisfied everybody and has reduced those emissions by over 97%. And at the time, I was told I was going to ruin the auto industry, the tractor industry, the heavy-duty truck industry. You know, they weren't going to be able to make engines. Nobody's had a problem with it. They've been able to do it, and we're healthier because of it. You see this happening over and over again. The mercury rule that was done, again, industry responds. They can do it. We are enormously innovative in this country. You have to set the timelines in an appropriate way. You can't expect them to make changes overnight, but you can do it.
You also testified yesterday that what you're seeing is an unprecedented attack on science-based regulations. When we talk about what's going on, much of this is not just happening within the administration itself. It's happening in Congress, too, because the environmental policies have the support of the majority of Republicans in Congress. What do you think is behind that? I mean, you're mentioning all these health concerns. Are they not concerned about such things?
I think they're concerned about health, but I think it's gotten so partisan now that that's what is driving a lot of it. I mean, it was interesting. Yesterday, for instance, the opening statement by the statements, plural, by the Republicans in attendance at the subcommittee were completely in line, for the most part, the opening statements with what we all thought. Then after we finished testifying and they were asked about it, you know, what do they think? They were all, no. The EPA is way overreached, and that was partisan politics talking. That wasn't policy. When you listen to the policy statements that they made at the beginning, they were very much in line with what we were asking.
Yeah, but the partisan politics become policy.
Unfortunately, they do, and that's what's happening. We see on almost every issue in Washington these days.
Do you have any confidence that your words and the words of your other former EPA administrators will produce any real results?
Well, we certainly hope so. And we certainly hope that the public will hear them and start to ask questions of their representatives saying, what do you feel about this? Aren't you concerned? How are you comfortable with rolling back this regulation in the face of industry, the particular industry being affected, saying, don't do it? Unfortunately, what you've seen from this administration is if Obama's name is anywhere near anything, it's gone, good, bad, or indifferent. I get, and I'm partisan, I've grown up in politics. I know that new administrations come in and they want to change things and make their own. But I've never seen this kind of wholesale, it's just out, without any consideration of the validity of a particular action. And that's what is deeply disturbing to me and I believe to the other former administrators.
That's Republican Christine Todd Whitman, former EPA administrator under President George W. Bush. She was also the governor of New Jersey. Governor Whitman, thank you.
My pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.